Hi, it's Katie.
And I'm Erin.
And we're at El Jardin in Wrigleyville.
And you're listening to Outside the Loop,
Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much, ladies. Love some El Jardin. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. It is wonderful to be here with you today for show number 978. And what we do here on the program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. And just days ago, Illinois leaders warned that 360,000 of our neighbors could lose food assistance, also known as SNAP benefits. That's the result of the so-called Big Beautiful Bill, which was signed July 4th, and that imposes stricter work mandates and shifts massive costs onto states. That means hardworking folks, veterans, formerly homeless individuals, young people aging out of foster care must now meet certain requirements and fill out the complex paperwork correctly, or else be at risk of losing support. And why are we doing this? To make government more efficient? Well, with the increased paperwork, that's probably not going to happen. To pay for tax cuts for those who probably don't really need them? That seems more likely here. Or here's a third possible avenue. Is this all just to be cruel? Because that's kind of the vibe I'm getting from all of this. Simultaneously, State Schools Superintendent Tony Sanders is sounding the alarm over the federal holdup of nearly $219 million slated to go to Illinois schools. That money is essential for the state's almost 2 million students. Sanders called the move deeply disruptive, saying it forces schools into budget limbo right when staff should be prepping for a new school year. Today on the show, we will explore the education impact of this federal funding freeze for Illinois. So here we are. Families possibly facing empty refrigerators, kids already behind, schools scrambling to catch up. And what do these actions tell us? It's up to us. We are the ones that need to step up right now. Support your local food pantries. They're bracing for a wave of demand. Volunteer your time, donate non-perishables, help pack meals, show up for schools. You can join a PTA. You can tutor or mentor students. Support after-school programs, because your presence makes funding gaps a little less devastating. And speak out, raise your voice, contact your state and federal representatives. Demand that human needs come before politics. Say loud and clear that we will stand up for children and for families in Chicago and in Illinois. I know that we say we're pretty divided these days, but if we don't fill these voids together, in the immediate future, it seems that no bureaucracy, no bailout is coming to do it for us. This is about our neighbors, and it's about our values. It's time to show that in Illinois, we don't leave people behind. So on the show today, we will talk about the potential impact of this school funding freeze. We'll also dive into some local music and a little bit of history. Last week, the U.S. Department of Education announced it was withholding nearly $7 billion in education funding for all 50 states. Illinois was slated to receive $218.7 million of that funding. So what's the potential impact of all this? Well, Samantha Smiley is a reporter at Chalk Beach, Chicago. It's a newsroom dedicated to covering local education. She's been following this story closely, and she joins us today to break it down. We could check out chalkbeat.org. Samantha, welcome back to the show. Nice to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me back. I'm glad to be here today.
Well, lots to talk about. So, all right, $7 billion. That's a lot of money. It was appropriated by Congress. What was this money going to be used for in Illinois?
That was $7 billion for states across the country. Illinois' little like pocket of money was $218.7 million. And regardless, like those funds were for federal grants that would help English learners, that would help students who were families of like migrant farmers, after school programming, teacher training, enrichment programs. So it was widespread.
So did Illinois end up receiving any of this? Because I know that July 1st was the date that the federal money was supposed to be sent to Illinois. Now that we are a couple weeks past that deadline, did Illinois get any of that? Because this was appropriated by Congress. So did anything make its way to the state?
Yeah, we're still waiting to hear if the state received it. We've had instances in the year where the Trump administration's Department of Education withheld funds and then had to give them back. But oftentimes it was due to a lawsuit. I'm also would have to check with the Attorney General Office of Kwame Raoul to see if they're thinking about pursuing a case against this. But yeah, it was appropriated by Congress earlier in the year, and for it not to have gone through, it's pretty interesting in this time.
Yeah. And you know, I'm just thinking about why this happened in the first place. I know this isn't the first time we're talking about the federal government withholding money during this Trump administration, but what was the reason given by the Department of Education, by the president? Why withhold this $7 billion across the country? Why withhold these funds?
The Trump administration's reasoning for withholding these funds for this, you know, this round of funding was, and I quote, "Initial findings have shown that many of these grant programs have been grossly misused to subsidize a radical left-wing agenda."
So it sounds like the government's saying that there's some political ideology being forced, or there's some sort of indoctrination happening. But these are programs that, like you're talking about, are going to help students with like after school programs, English language learners. So those folks who maybe are in school, but English isn't their first language. That's the intent, but the government's saying that there's something else, like a undercover sort of secret plan that's really what these funds are being used for.
Yeah, and so my colleague Caitlin Belsha at the national desk at Chalkbeat, that is what she received when she wrote up about the national impact, and it is still pretty unclear, like what are they specifically talking about? What are the left wing agendas that they're mentioning, and what does that look like for each state? It is like we don't really know.
Yeah. So the impact of this move, I mean, COVID relief money is basically gone in Illinois. And I know that schools and the state were really relying on that stimulus money. That is not a thing anymore. So in terms of the federal money, this $218.7 million that Illinois was slated to receive from the federal government, how reliant is Illinois on that money? How significant is that? Because I'm thinking about what is the possible impact of what's going on here with this withholding?
Yeah, I think that state education officials would say like every dollar counts. Because especially when you already have programs in play and then they lose some type of money, because all school districts around the state and probably across the country are mixing funds together in order to create some of the programs that they have. So any cut in funds could be really harmful to a school district or school and its programming. It's not even just them pulling funds. It's also like when they're doing it, that feels pretty disruptive. When they're doing it, the fact that, like you said, there's, you know, COVID-19 funds have run out. The state was able to put in $307 million more dollars into the evidence-based funding formula for K-12 schools. But, you know, advocates have been asking for an additional $550 million. Every year, because the cost of things have gone up, you know, it is like every dollar pretty much counts at this point. And we, you know, journalists in the education space have already been talking about how hard this year and next year is going to be because of the loss in COVID-19 funds. Now we just have to assume that it's going to be even worse because of the instability when it comes to federal funds at this time.
And Chicago Public Schools was expecting to receive, I think that was about $90 million. That's on hold. The CPS budget, there's a deficit there. I think it's $734 million. So they're laying off over 160 employees. So it feels like, I mean, everyone was kind of banking on this money coming our way. And now there's going to be a mad scramble to try to figure things out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like I said, yeah, Chicago Public Schools have a huge budget deficit. And, you know, other school districts are going through it as well. And now you have like other federal programs that could be cut that didn't seem like they were intertwined with schools, but they actually are when you look at them. And so now it's like, how are schools going to be able to feed kids? How are they going to ensure that they have the necessary access to, you know, healthcare or therapeutic services, especially for students with disabilities? How are they going to have after school programming? How are they going to do these things if there's really no money there? And then when they turn around, like money is just taken away.
Yeah. So in terms of what's being done here, is the state fighting back? Are there lawsuits being explored here? What steps are being taken to try to get some of this money back?
Right now, I've heard from Superintendent Tony Sanders via like statements that like he believes that this is, you know, deeply disruptive to schools. We're still on the watch out to see for this specific pot of money if there would be a lawsuit. I'm just keeping an eye out on like what next year's federal budget is going to look like for schools. But yeah, we'll definitely at Chalkview be keeping an eye on it to see what's going on.
And one more issue kind of turning a little bit here, Samantha. I know that there was a lot of momentum in terms of trying to ban cell phones in Illinois schools during the school day. And there is a bill that is in the Illinois Senate SB 2427, but that potential ban seems to be on hold right now. What's going on with this issue?
Yeah, so the bill that you mentioned, SB 2427, did make it to the House, but I think it got lost in the shuffle of like the end of session. And as you know, like end of session is pretty busy with trying to get through major bills, to get through the budget process at that, especially before the holidays kick in. I think it just got lost in the scramble. When I have talked to the Senate sponsor, who is Christina Castro, she said that, you know, that they're still going to be working on the bill, that she thinks that there needs to be some fine tuning to the language, but she has no, like, she's not, you know, concerned about whether it'll get through. It's just about the time.
All right. Well, lots to keep an eye on at Chalkbeat Chicago. And I know that you and your colleagues at Chalkbeat, Samantha, will be doing just that. We can check out chalkbeat.org for all of the wonderful education reporting Chicago and in Illinois, really a great wealth of education information on chalkbeat.org. Samantha Smiley is a reporter at Chalkbeat Chicago. Samantha, I always appreciate the time. Thank you so much for your reporting and thanks for talking to us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. I'm always happy to talk to you.
And let's get into some local music. Local-ish. I say, no, it's local. It's definitely local because this music coming from Kate Fagan, who is known for her work fronting the legendary Chicago ska band Heavy Manners, and so many gigs that Kate has played here in Chicago. And Kate is with us today on Outside the Loop. And now I say local-ish because, Kate, first of all, it's great to talk to you again, but you're not currently based in Chicago, right?
No, I'm not, Mike. I live in New Orleans, Louisiana.
I've heard of it.
Yeah, I've heard. And which is, it's great. It's really culturally fabulous. I hear a lot of music that has the deep roots of our country, a lot of the feelings and connections to the history here. And the sounds are mainly brass, funk, some Zydeco and jazz. But honestly, there's not much rock and roll. So I haven't been able to express, you know, my rock and roll spirit in entirety here. And I'm looking forward to going to Chicago that really rocks out and really rocking out there.
Yeah, we like to rock out. That I could say about Chicago.
I think so.
I do think it is interesting, though. I mean, I've been to New Orleans a couple of times, and one of the cool things that I think is actually similar to Chicago is you have what I like to call the nooks and crannies. So you could go into New Orleans, you know, even outside of the French Quarter, and you could find these little joints that maybe are playing Zydeco or jazz or something like that. Kind of like in Chicago, where you can go to these neighborhood joints, and now it's like, hey, we can turn our storefront bar into a little venue in the back or something like that. So I think maybe there's a little, you know, overlap there or a connection between the two cities.
Yeah, I think some of the, if you want to go hear music, I think there are a lot of opportunities to get, you know, up close and personal with it and to stay within your neighborhood or to get into a neighborhood. Especially right now, our Bywater neighborhood has a lot of clubs in it. They tend to have some more experimental and rock music down there as well. And that's become kind of a, I don't know, like an East Village or, you know, maybe, you know, a place where really it's really hatching a lot of new sounds and a lot of new excitement. And those are neighborhood bars down there. I live a little further uptown, so I'm near the Maple Leaf Bar and Snake and Jake's and the Carrollton Station. So yes, it's really easy to go over and just sit at the bar and hear some really interesting and great music. And sometimes some of the best players are in the smaller places.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. So look, you are someone who rocks. You've been rocking for so long, and like I said, you are known for really fronting heavy manners, and you guys played all over Chicago and beyond in that band. And I know that, and we've talked about how ska, you know, I think at one time, like, that was kind of the thing. I mean, so many people were just jamming out to ska music. And it's interesting because I think back, even when I was in college, I mean, I was going to see ska bands. And now I got to be honest, I don't know where I could go. I mean, I'm sure I could find it in Chicago, but like, it was so ubiquitous. I feel like, you know, 20, 25 years ago, what happened there with ska?
Well, I don't know about the Chicago scene with ska, honestly. I'm more connected to getting notifications from a more international scene. I think in Europe and Canada and some places in Los Angeles and also some places on the East Coast, I think ska is still really big. I don't know what happened in Chicago. It seemed like when I was exiting Chicago, that a lot of bands were becoming cover bands of 80s and 90s music, and that became really popular. I don't think a lot of clubs really supported a reggae vibe that was so much important to the birth of ska music and to keep ska music going. So I think reggae kind of became less popular. I think ska kind of in some ways followed that.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I know there were a few reggae clubs in Chicago that they're no more. They're gone. It's an interesting kind of thing to think about here. But you are rocking here. You've got some new-ish music out. Tell us about some of the new songs out, because for sure, you're rocking here, Kate.
Yeah, I am. Well, first of all, I'm working with a guitar player. His name is Jeremy Joyce, and I'm bringing him with me to Chicago. I've got a really, really great group of people that are coming with me. They really celebrate the spirit of the punk era. They're naturally punks. They love the individuality, the idea of, you know, self-expression that's more heightened. So it's exciting to work with them. The song Go Faster that Jeremy and I just put out in January, that song is really a political statement about New Orleans, that so many projects here, so many initiatives here have slowed down. And in my own case, you know, the building a road right in front of my house got slowed down to take at least a year. And it was just this kind of feeling like there are so many problems out there. We've identified them. We've talked over all these problems from every different issue. And this is nationally, internationally, but of course, locally here in New Orleans. But like, let's go faster. We need to really move on some stuff because it's only going backwards. So go faster was an expression of that, which of course, you know, I like to be able to express myself in terms of my politics and, you know, the things I feel deeply about.
We don't need a committee to tell us things ain't pretty. We don't want to wait to sue and litigate. It's the same old ground and we won't stand around. We want to go faster.
Yeah, I think those are things that we can relate to. And you will be bringing this music and much more to Chicago coming up in August here. So a couple of dates here. So the big show, Sunday, August 10th at the Empty Bottle. Love the Empty Bottle, right on Western and Cortez. What a great spot. You're playing there. Tell us about that gig.
Well, very excited to play that gig. We're so up for it. The Jen Larson's band Beastie, and Jen Larson wrote Hit Girls about women in punk. Mm-hmm. She was the author of that book, and her band is playing first. It's Beastie, then my band will be on, Kate Fagan Band, and then after that is Clickbait, which is Jen LeMaster's band, and she of course is the co-owner of Brick-a-Brac Records.
And it all is synergistic because the day before you were going to be at Brick-a-Brac Records, that's at 2845 North Milwaukee Avenue in Chicago, 4 p.m.
Right.
For an in-store performance.
In-store performance. It'll be, of course, all ages. And if you haven't been in there, it's like walking into Pee-wee's Playhouse, especially if Pee-wee was really into horror movies.
Yeah.
That's going to be a lot of fun. They have, it's a BYOB and they also have a cafe there. So it'll be a nice little reception and party, and we are going to play. We're going to get up there and really do it. Not just a couple of songs, but we're going to really try to do, you know, most of our set.
Fantastic. So that's a special in-store performance at Brick-a-Brac Records, Saturday, August 9th at 4 p.m. That's 2845 North Milwaukee Avenue. And then Sunday, August 10th at the Empty Bottle in Chicago. So, okay, you've got these two gigs in Chicago. It's so cool that you get to come back here and perform. What's next? More music? What do you have down the line in 2025?
Well, I'm playing a gig this Friday here in New Orleans. And of course, I always do my Ho 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 show, my kind of naughty Christmas venue review. I have a few other songs that I'm working on with Jeremy. We intend to press them and put them out before the end of this year. So I'm working on that. And I'll probably do something big in New Orleans as part of the Halloween culture here. I've done a couple of witching balls here, produced them and played at them. And I might do that again this year. I'm going to be thinking about that because Halloween in New Orleans has become a huge celebration.
Fantastic. Well, there's good stuff just, you know, down the road here on the horizon for you, Kate Fagan, who, of course, local for a long time, local musician now based in New Orleans. We could check out your website, Kate2CoolFagan.com. Kate2CoolFagan.com. Saturday, August 9th at Brick-a-Brac Records. Sunday, August 10th at the Empty Bottle. Go see Kate Fagan and her band and all of the wonderful musicians. Kate, it's great to talk to you. Thanks so much for the time today.
Oh, wonderful to talk to you, Mike. Thank you for calling.
Okay. Occasionally in the Chicago Reader, you will see the column, The Secret History of Chicago Music. It is hand-drawn by local musician, music historian, and artist Plastic Crime Wave. He's also known as Steve Krakow. This strip profiles a local musician or a band who never quite made it to the big time. So right now, let's dim those lights. Let's fire up the old hi-fi as we travel to Chicago's Ukrainian Village neighborhood and enter
The Secret History of Chicago Music.
Once again, connecting across town to the lair of an apartment of Steve Krakow, who is the author of The Secret History of Chicago Music Strip in the Chicago Reader and online at chicagoreader.com. And Steve, this week, this is pretty cool because who we're talking about here, Byron Gregory, he is someone that I'm sure a lot of people don't know, but we should know him, and you got a chance to talk to him. This kind of grew out of the recent 20th anniversary celebration of The Secret History of Chicago Music at the Hideout. Tell us how all this got rolling here.
Yeah, so this was kind of nuts, and, you know, I'm okay. So 20th anniversary of Secret History of Chicago Music. It happened technically in May, and we had an event at Hideout in June. Sort of did a little hybrid, like, panel discussions with some of the artists and then, like, a concert later on. And, yeah, so one of the panel discussions was basically on Chicago soul, and I was talking with Ronaldo Domino, an artist I covered a long time ago. Great honey voice soul singer, and Jackie Ross, another one I covered a little more recently, another great soul singer, had a sort of expert, wrote a book on Chicago soul, Aaron Cohen, on there. And, you know, it's going really well. So I sort of whipped out this single by Jackie Ross that is a real, I guess, a pretty obscure one. I saw the look on her face when I whipped it out. She was kind of like, whoa. I honestly, she's like, basically she was like, there's another label that owes me money I forgot about, you know? So it caught her off guard. Sad that that's the case, because a lot of people in the industry, that's how it is. But, and I was like, you know, what do you remember about this single? Because it's really unique for her catalog. It sort of got like a more like kind of funky, wah-wah kind of psychedelic sound. And, you know, I'm like, do you remember anything about the session? Like, who's playing guitar in it? They sound really good and everything. You know, and I kind of assumed it was maybe like a Phil Upchurch or a Pete Cozy, one of these sort of ace session cats from the day. And this voice just chimes in from the audience, goes, that was me. That was me on guitar. And I was like, wait, what? What? And, you know, we had just been sort of discussing, you know, 20 years of sort of cosmic convergences that have sort of happened with the strip where, you know, I meet someone's dad who was in a band that I've been wondering about for a decade and, you know, stuff like that. And I was like, wow. So, you know, I talked to him after the show, and it turned out, you know, that Mr. Cohen brought him there because he had interviewed him extensively for a book he had just done about Ramsey Lewis. And he was not only a player for Ramsey Lewis, Byron, so many other people. And we just started talking, and we both agreed. I'm like, that was kind of cosmic, wasn't it? And he was like, yeah, it was, you know. And it was. And he said, man, I'm a big fan of your column since the beginning. And I'm like, what? Oh, man, you know. Like, the whole thing kind of choked me up. The whole night was me going, oh, man, you know. But right. They got me a cake, you know. It was that kind of night. It was special. So, yeah, you know, I went and poked around online, and I could see he had about 100 things on Discogs that he's credited on, and from what Aaron Cohen told me, so many more we didn't know about. So I'm like, all right, we got to get into this, and I did about a 3-hour interview and change with him, one of the longest on record for Secret History, and so much stuff I could not include. You know, the outtakes column would be fantastic as well, but managed to get his story, and it's quite a story.
Yeah, so we'll just kind of, you know, scratch the surface here, much more in the column, The Secret History of Chicago Music. We're talking about Byron Gregory. He was in the audience at that Secret History of Chicago Music 20th anniversary celebration at the Hideout. So, Steve, you talked to him. He's born in Bronzeville in 1952. You know, kind of the same story that we've heard from other African-American artists around that time, his family coming up from Georgia and Mississippi, getting out of the Jim Crow South. They're looking for a better situation up here in the North. And he's living on the South Side. And Coco Taylor shared an apartment with his family?
I mean, basically the mind-blowing story started from the beginning. And, you know, and he's like, yeah, according to my mom, she would nurse me when my mom wasn't around.
Oh, man.
And I was like, okay, so you were kind of literally raised at the teat of music here, you know, basically. Dare we say literally. So, that just kind of blew my mind right from the beginning. I still don't exactly know the circumstances behind her living there, but we had to just keep going. We had to keep going. There was too much ground to cover.
Right. So he's playing music at a very early age. He gets a guitar early on, and he is just picking up a lot of the popular songs of the day by ear. He's, you know, kind of hooking up with some doo-wop groups when he's very young. And he's already kind of at age 14 catching the ear of a producer, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of crazy. I mean, he's a very precocious young lad. He was basically like classically trained, you know, while in his young teens, it seems like, and, you know, learned to read music at his grandparents' insistence, who got him a guitar. And then, you know, so he's like actually, you know, a good musician, but then also like so young, you know, and hip, like as to what's going on and the sort of sound, you know, that's happening, and maybe a generation younger than, you know, a lot of the cats who are playing and studio guys and stuff like that. So, yeah, he starts playing these talent shows, which was basically the scene when you were a teenager about all you could do. And yeah, the Clarence Johnson, who had been in the Chi Lights and was a interesting producer guy, covered bands I've written up in Secret History before, like the Love Lights, Patty and the Love Lights. He was producing all these singles and kind of releasing them on his own little tiny labels, each one with like a new name for each. It was kind of hard to follow the catalog of. You know, stuff that he did, but he sort of became, Byron sort of became like his, you know, go-to session guitarist guy.
So he gets eventually hooked up with Ramsey Lewis, and we've talked about Ramsey Lewis in this segment before, and Ramsey Lewis, to all of us here in Chicago, I mean, talk about just an institution. He has this big collaboration with Ramsey Lewis.
Yeah, total legend, and you know, dabbled in every genre, and you know, was a complete elder statesman of, you know, jazz piano in general. But the guy who brought him in was another legend, Charles Stepney, who produced the most hit-making golden period of Earth, Wind, and Fire, and wrote a lot of that material. That would probably be his number one thing, but also The Emotions. He had a sort of psychedelic project for Chess called Rotary Connection. Very unique sound, total legend, and he basically caught wind of, you know, of Byron's abilities and was like, hey, why don't you come play in this demo in my basement? Didn't really even know what it was. And it was a Ramsey song. And Ramsey, he was sort of pushing Ramsey into this, or naturally going to this sort of fusion period, which ended up being very popular, actually. Sun Goddess, the album that he ended up first recording, that album went gold, huge. It was huge, and it's good. It's really good, sort of right in the pocket there of, you know, jazz fusion. So yeah, he's suddenly in this band. He's making these sort of hit making records and even going on the road with Ramsey and opening for Earth, Wind, and Fire at the peak of their fame, basically.
Oh, So, all right, we probably don't know the name Byron Gregory, but he goes on, I mean, to play. He's playing jingles. He's doing a lot of studio work. He's also doing property development, which is amazing. And is that kind of where he is today?
Yeah. It's really, you know, it's a unique trajectory. There were just a couple dudes who were hip enough to, you know, aren't smart enough to look ahead and be like, you know, I don't know if this music thing's going to be totally sustainable. And one of them was this dude, Gerald Sims, total legend, who we talked about a while back. He basically, that's him doing the guitar on Higher and Higher by Jackie Wilson, basically.
Nice.
It's basically his lick. Total legend, arranger, producer for Chess, songwriter. He was smart enough to start getting in on property management kind of early on, probably when buildings were cheap, you know, on the South Side. And he said his buddy Phil Upchurch was like, here, this is a good bank you go to. He was savvy too. And yeah, he, you know, was able to sort of have that to fall back on, because he, you know, he kept doing session work in the later 70s. But after being on the road with Ramsey for some years, the life really got to him. He had to get out for his, he basically said to live, to keep on living. It's a hard life. It's a decadent life. He didn't go into all the temptations of the road, but I got the vibe. And, you know, he came back to his family. His wife was a very active churchgoer, got him involved in her church, and he said he really was saved. And yet he kept on doing like all these, I mean, did like 8 albums with Tyrone Davis, you know, like he still kept doing these amazing stuff. Did a Smokey Robinson album in the late, I mean, he made it sound like to me he left the biz, and I'm like, man, I'm looking at you, some really impressive stuff for leaving the biz here, you know. And then he kind of went into gospel, which actually had a pretty big resurgence in the 80s. You know, I'm sure you remember like Amy Grant riding up the charts and that kind of stuff, right? You know, So yeah, it kind of had a little resurgence. So he actually kept busy with that. But then at the same time, not only went from property management, he went more into condos, because that was the big thing in the 80s, and started kind of chopping up his units. And he's still doing stuff. He's still like helping people set up buildings, and yeah, that's definitely his main biz these days. But he's got such a passion for the music. You can just tell. And really, you know, he told me he gave free lessons to kids at the church and stuff. So just a really great guy.
That's awesome. He's still doing it at age 72, Byron Gregory. You can get the full story in the Secret History of Chicago Music column in the Chicago Reader, and online at chicagoreader.com. Steve Krakow is the author of that strip. He's also a local musician, artist, and music historian, and he hand draws a picture of who he's profiling so you could see his rendition of Byron Gregory. Steve, hey man, a great story this week. And as always, I mean, stay funky, stay soulful. Good tunes. I think we could just celebrate that. This guy, all about good tunes, Byron Gregory.
Definitely. And if you want to check out the song that introduced us, it's Jackie Ross's Dr. Slap's Man Is Born. If you can remember that title, it's worth checking out.
Dr. Slap's, and a new life is born into a world. And told so innocent, he don't know what kind of world is he.
And that'll do it. Outside the Loop show number 978 is done. Thank you so much for listening to the show today. I hope you have a wonderful week. And I'll talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.